The 1970s may go down on record as the decade in which Americans first took action to reverse the trend of steadily increasing environmental pollution. And it is due time that serious steps were taken. We've all seen industry broadcast publicity on anti-pollution moves which have some sales value. Low-lead gasolines, no-phosphate detergents. And most of us are aware that major industries faced with costly cleanups of no real sales value have taken a low-profile attitude while they await legislative action. Our environment, land, water, air, climate, nature, is important to us as citizens. As electrical engineers, there are contributions we can make professionally to some of the problems the country faces. What's more, the solutions of many of these problems open new areas of engineering design and problem solving. Many of us will be employed in this area within a few years if national goals and priorities follow directions now evident. IEEE Soundings wanted to bring you the most pertinent information available in this area. We covered a number of technical sessions at conferences on both coasts and selected talks which we feel convey both the potential and the pragmatics of this complex area. We've concentrated on those with suggestions for action. At the conclusion of the tape, we'll direct you to IEEE and external publications for more specific study, but now on to our speakers. We open with Hugh Hefner, an IEEE director who currently fills a top position in the U.S. Office of Science and Technology. Hugh sees specific needs to which EEs should make significant contributions. They cover almost the entire environmental area.
One of the problems we face is that we have no comprehensive monitoring of our environment. We need to keep constant track of such things as the carbon monoxide or hydrocarbon or sulfur oxide content of the atmosphere. We need monitoring of the nutrient content, the bacteria count, the particle concentrations and chemical pollutants of many of our lakes and streams. If we expect to clean up our air and water, we need to know what is happening. Unfortunately, we do not have the instrumentation to do the job effectively. Probably the most up-to-date monitoring system is the Continuous Air Monitoring Program of the National Air Pollution Control Administration. This program includes stations in half a dozen major cities to monitor continuously in a semi-automatic way the concentrations of sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitric oxide, nitrogen dioxide, methane, hydrocarbons, and particle content in the air. The technology used is more than 10 years old, and each station requires an operator and an air-conditioned building. What we need are inexpensive, reliable, automatic instruments using the latest in the state of the art. The federal government has set strict standards on automobile emissions in the coming years. Beginning in 1973, new cars will have to exhibit markedly reduced emissions of hydrocarbons, nitrogen oxides, carbon monoxide, and particulates. However, unless those new cars continue to show low emission levels as they grow older, the whole effect of the standards will be compromised. Yet we have no simple instruments which allow the local garage to make a check on an automobile's exhaust. We're much concerned about sulfur oxides, the caustic chemicals and particulates emitted in the stack gases of power plants and manufacturing facilities. Yet again, our instruments for monitoring stack gas content, particularly for monitoring remotely, are rudimentary. The electronics engineer has a whole bag of tricks which can be used in solving these problems. He knows how to make low-frequency conductivity, dielectric and magnetic measurements. He knows how to use microwaves to measure magnetic resonance. And perhaps most useful of all, he's beginning to master the optical spectrum. Raman effect, molecular resonance, tunable lasers, optical radar are not foreign words to him. What are some of the other obvious arenas for the electrical engineer? One that has tended to decline from neglect is power engineering. It is in the production of power that some of our pollution problems are most severe. Let me set the stage. Until recently, as historical reckoning goes, man's energy supply came from his own muscles and those of his domesticated animals. Only relatively recently has society relied on chemical energy. And even as short as a century ago, 75% of this nation's inanimate energy was supplied by the burning of wood. By 1900, wood supplied only 21%, and coal had become the leading source with 71%. Now oil and gas are dominant, together accounting for about three-quarters of the energy produced. In 1968, the U.S. consumption of energy was slightly over 6.2 times 10 to the 16th BTUs and is growing at a rate of about 3.2% per year, over twice as fast as the growth of population. Of this total, about 23% was devoted to generating electrical power. The use of electrical power has been increasing by over 5% per year, so that 30 years from now, when the total energy consumption is expected to reach 17 times 10 to the 16th BTUs, approximately half may be devoted to the generation of electricity. This is a staggering increase in generating capacity. Without specific attention, it could bring with it staggering environmental problems. The electrical engineer can help in avoiding those problems. His talents can be used in reducing the emissions from conventionally fueled steam power plants, reducing the probability of blackouts or brownouts, improving the technology to reduce or eliminate unsightly transmission lines, and developing cleaner sources of electrical power. Let me mention some of the things that need doing. For example, in the control of emissions, although the major contaminant in conventionally fueled power plants is sulfur dioxide, the emission of particulate matter is also a problem. That it is not the primary problem is due to many years of past effort. We now have, in standard use, electrostatic precipitators, which remove up to 98 or 99% of the particulate emissions. Yet this impressive efficiency is not enough. We need not only to remove an even higher fraction of the total, but we need ways to capture the submicron particles that are not now being removed. We have increasing concern that these particles may have particular significance to human health and to possible long-term climatic changes. Most of you remember the celebrated East Coast blackout of a few years ago. Some say that its chief environmental effect was the anomalous peak in the birth rate which suddenly appeared in the following year's census. Be that as it may, the systems engineer still has a still pressing use for his talents if we are to avoid repetition of regional blackouts. Some of the most scarring features of our countryside are the ugly rows of steel towers, insulators, and transmission lines carrying electrical power often for hundreds of miles. In the cities, the eyesores are worse, with an overhead net of wires held up by poles every few hundred feet. To put the relatively low voltage lines underground costs about nine times as much. And we don't have the technology to place the very high KVA lines underground. The electrical engineer can contribute markedly to the attractiveness of the country by developing economical methods of undergrounding both high and medium voltage power lines. Much can be done to improve the environmental quality by freeing some of the constraints imposed on the siting of power stations resulting from present-day technological limits on the size and efficiency of overhead transmission systems. We need a capability to carry power at 1,000 to 1,500 kilovolts. We need extra high-voltage systems which operate at DC rather than AC. New and better solid-state switching devices may make that possible. Of course, the major way that the electrical engineer can contribute to eliminating environmental pollution from energy sources is to develop cleaner sources. The great hope of the future is fusion energy, and many electrical engineers are involved in its development. I find it interesting that the current wave of excitement and optimism among the fusion people comes from a marriage of lasers and plasmas, each having been the subject of considerable effort on the part of electrical engineers these past years. There is another marriage of technologies, or at least a ménage à trois, which some believe represents a solution to our energy problems. It is a combination of satellite technology with semiconductor solar cells and high-powered microwave techniques. A recent technical memorandum submitted to the Office of Science and Technology proposes a satellite solar power station capable of generating 10 million kilowatts, about 2.5 times the power consumed by New York City. It would involve 25 square miles of solar cells, conversion of their output to microwave power, and a 1.5 mile diameter dish to transmit that power to the Earth. The authors believe that something like 10% overall efficiency could be obtained, and the system costs would be about $500 per kilowatt. They show that if nothing else, it is not only the high-energy physicist who thinks big. Certainly, a successful exploitation of solar energy would be the least damaging to the environment. Perhaps we should not reject the suggestion without more thought. If all of our coal, oil, and gas were completely purified, there would still result the two inevitable combustion products, water vapor and carbon dioxide. So far as we know, the water vapor presents no environmental problems. The carbon dioxide, on the other hand, may be a time bomb for climatic change. The amount of CO2 in the world's atmosphere has increased about 13% since 1900. It correlates well with the increase expected from the burning of fossil fuels over that period. At our present rate of fuel consumption, we are generating an amount of carbon dioxide each year equivalent to nearly 1% of the total atmospheric CO2 content. By the end of the century, it is possible that we may produce each year an amount equal to 4% of the total now present. Why is this worrisome? Simply because we know that CO2 is transparent to visible light, but is a strong absorber in the infrared. Thus, increased concentrations of carbon dioxide can cause the atmosphere to act like a gigantic greenhouse, allowing the sun's visible energy to heat up the Earth, but trapping the long-wave energy normally re-radiated by the Earth. Indeed, between 1900 and 1940, there was observed to be an average world temperature rise of 0.4 of a degree centigrade. Carbon dioxide is not the whole story, however. Man's activities are also generating fine dust from industry, from agriculture, and from the combustion process itself. Much of this dust finds itself suspended in the atmosphere, and once there, blocks an appreciable amount of the sunlight from reaching the Earth. Moreover, these small particles form condensation nuclei, which can encourage the formation of clouds, further reducing the amount of solar energy reaching the Earth. Thus, these two effects of human activity, production of carbon dioxide and production of fine particles of dust, act in opposite directions, insofar as the Earth's heat balance is concerned. Recent measurements of atmospheric turbidity seem to show substantial increases in the last decade or so. It may be that this effect is responsible for the decrease in average world temperature observed during the last two decades. Perhaps the temperature effects which we have experienced in the last 70 years or so are unrelated to man's activities. We just do not know. Yet the knowledge is of immense importance to our environmental future. Let me mention a few other areas where electrical engineers can contribute to a solution of environmental problems. One of the most critical catastrophes these days is the massive oil spill. Beginning with a breakup of the 120,000-ton Torrey Canyon off the coast of Cornwall, we have been treated to a series of oil disasters of major proportions. A part of our reaction is due to an increased ecological sensitivity. For many years, we have averaged about 100 oil spills of varying intensity each year. Yet there is very little question that as the scope of man's activities become larger, the consequences of accident also becomes larger. We really have no very good way of coping with a large oil spill in the ocean. We can try to contain it by a surrounding circle of barges while pumping up the oil and water mixture. But this tactic is frustrated by high seas. We can pour on detergents, but these chemicals can do more damage than the oil. Once the oil reaches the shore, we really are in trouble. The only solution we know then is to use straw to soak it up and sandblasting to remove it from the rocks and cliffs along the shoreline. I wonder if the electrical engineer, unlikely as it may seem, could help in this problem. Is it possible, for instance, to use ultrasonic techniques to emulsify the oil before it reaches the shore? Probably not, but is worth some thought. Finally, let me mention the special place of the systems engineer. His specialty, or perhaps I should say generality, was spawned by the increasing complexity of military electronic systems, which had to take into account not only the capabilities of individual components, but also how those components could be fitted together best to accomplish the overall purpose. He is trained to think in terms of cost-effectiveness. He is trained to look at the functional integration of subsystems, each having its own input-output parameters. These are exactly the talents needed to solve some of our most thorny environmental problems. Let me give an example. If we visualize how we supply water and remove liquid waste from our cities, we see a startling dissymmetry. In California, for instance, water is carried for hundreds of miles in huge underground pipes from the north to the south. Branch lines serve cities along the way. Yet once that water is used, each city has one or scores of separate sewage treatment plants, each of which dumps its contents into a local stream or bay or lake. Why couldn't we construct a system which would collect waste on the same scale as we transport water? Why couldn't we treat the waste as it traverses the hundreds of miles to the sea and achieve the economies of scale which have served us so well in other industries? These are the kinds of questions which the systems engineer is equipped to answer. Although the problems of environmental pollution may have strong social and political components, the technological key may be the best means of opening the lock. In some cases, it is indispensable. Moreover, the electrical engineer has a significant role to play. Not only does he have the ability to provide the instruments to monitor the levels of pollution, but he is also in the best position to provide some of the most important alternative technologies that will enhance our environmental quality.
Environmental concerns divide into two basic areas: those in which problems are cumulative, such as air, water, and land spoilage, and pesticide accumulations, and those which are non-cumulative, such as audio and electromagnetic pollution. In a second dimension, there is pollution which affects our health, for example, the need for pure drinking water. Other pollution affects our comfort, for example, the presence of unpleasant but non-dangerous odor producers in the air we breathe. And other pollution offends our aesthetic senses, the auto graveyards, and the conversion of undeveloped land to industrial or residential uses. There are other dimensions to the pollution problem. For example, the use of regulations or taxes to deter polluters and as a spur to the development of new technology which will eliminate or reduce pollution. Our history has shown that regulatory practices alone have not done the job when polluters can bring political pressures to bear. Happily, an increasing tide of public opinion seems to be overcoming the economic power of industries which have often opposed regulation. Technical solutions which in the past have missed being economically attractive now have increasing chances for application. To illustrate one such area, consider the problem of water management. Alan Seward, who is Director of Applied Science and Technology, Federal Water Quality Administration of the U.S. Department of the Interior, will show us that this field, one of relatively simple hardware technology, requires sophisticated systems design and management.
In the urban areas of our country, we have accelerated the rate of water extraction from our rivers, lakes, and aquifers beyond the rate of replenishment through the natural hydrologic cycle. Currently, we discharge our used waters to rivers at such a low quality so as to render their reuse by downstream cities almost impossible, or at best, very expensive. What does it take to achieve a national objective for clean water? Based upon field testing and mathematical simulation of the responses of water courses to waste loads, we are finding that to restore the desired water quality in urbanized areas, we must remove 95% or more of the pollutants from our sanitary and industrial waste before discharge. And we must capture and purify most of our stormwater runoff, which washes considerable quantities of pollutants from the surface of the urban watershed. When wastewaters are purified to this extent, the quality of the discharge begins to approach or exceed the quality of the receiving water, and should more properly be called renovated water. If a city is implementing this type of water quality control, and most of our cities will have to sooner or later, and is also experiencing a water shortage, the obvious question arises, after all that, why throw it away? Now, many cities have begun to ask that question. First, it was in the obviously water-short areas, California, Texas, Arizona, Mexico. But now we are hearing reuse of renovated wastewater discussed as a valid alternative for meeting future supplies in such water-rich areas as Chicago, Long Island, and even here in Washington, D.C. The use of wastewaters for something other than augmenting river flows amounts to a short-circuiting of the hydrologic cycle on a small scale, which results in a deceleration of the net water extraction rate on a continental or regional basis. For example, if a city is using 100 million gallons a day of water and installs renovation equipment permitting a reuse of 80% of that water, obviously its demand for new water is decreased to only 20 million gallons per day, and 80 million gallons per day are retained in the natural hydrologic cycle. Now, the answer to whether a city should go to reuse is not simple, for there are infinite degrees of water reuse, ranging from our current natural reuse by the next city downstream, to total recycle of renovated wastewaters into the city's general water supply system. Many complex economic, engineering, and sociological questions must be answered in designing an optimum urban hydrologic cycle. The first market to be considered for reuse of wastewater effluents is that of subpotable demand. Effluents from conventional secondary waste treatment plants have been used in several locations for industrial cooling water and irrigation of non-edible crops. With increasing levels of treatment, the renovated wastewater becomes suitable for groundwater recharge, edible plant irrigation, recreational lakes, domestic subpotable applications, and ultimately drinking water. Each of these uses has a certain production cost and a certain market which are unique to each metropolitan area. Further expanding the range of alternatives are the possibility of capture and treatment of stormwater for reuse and desalination of brackish or saline water. Proper engineering analysis of the hydrologic cycle in urban regions requires a complicated system analysis supported by large volumes of data on water sources, water demands, treatment costs, and transportation costs. The Federal Water Quality Administration is currently developing and testing computer methods for performing these complex analyses. Also, ancillary to the water use operation is a process called private recycle. This represents all cases where a particular user improves the quality of some portion of his wastewater for reuse in the same process or another process. Private or industrial recycle represents the greatest portion of deliberate reuse currently practiced. A classic example of this is that of an industrial plant renovating its processed wastewater to a degree suitable for cooling water. In many cases, this proves to be more economical than purchasing municipal potable water for cooling purposes. Many industries are now recognizing the economic advantages of complete recycle of processed water, reclaiming both the water and the processed materials dispersed in the water, which have turned pollutants once discharged from the plant. The ultimate in recycle, or closing the loop, is, of course, recycle of the public wastewater directly back to the supply. Despite our technical capabilities, this type of reuse has been somewhat ignored because of the psychological factors involved. The current reuse scheme, wherein a city's effluents are discharged to a stream, diluted and decayed to some degree, and then withdrawn for supply by the next downstream community, doesn't seem to bother us as much, though. In other words, the use of another's treated sewage is acceptable, whereas the use of one's own treated sewage is unacceptable. The existence of advanced water purification technology destroys the logic of this traditional attitude. This reuse reluctance, however, has caused many cities to go to great expense for alternative water sources, so such as building large reservoirs and transporting water hundreds and hundreds of miles. Direct recycle is currently practiced in Windhoek, Southwest Africa, for example, and was employed in the United States during the 5-month drought period in Chinook, Kansas in 1956. Using only conventional waste treatment and water supply treatment, a safe water was supplied to Chinook. However, by 1956 technology, taste, odor, and color made the water somewhat undesirable. In a permanent system designed for reuse with today's technology, clear, tasteless, odorless water can be produced. The first model for analyzing these problems was developed and tested by the staff of the Federal Water Quality Administration. The test case, and this is going back 2 or 3 years, the test case was the Richmond, Petersburg, Hampton Roads region in Virginia, along the James River estuary, covering a distance of 80 miles. Water sources assumed in that model were reservoirs in the upper James Basin, groundwater in both the Hampton Roads and Richmond area, desalting of 500 parts per million estuary water near Richmond, desalting of 1,000 parts per million estuary water near Petersburg, desalting of ocean water, which is 35,000 parts per million, direct reuse of renovated wastewater at Hampton Roads, and direct reuse of renovated wastewater at a common plant to be used both by Richmond and Petersburg. Now, it was assumed that the various supplies could be interconnected. Using the best data available at that time from various agencies within the Department of the Interior, the model was coded and operated. For meeting needs in the year 2020, the model showed that the least cost solution would be for Hampton Roads to use 100% surface water and the Richmond area to use 78% surface water, with the remainder coming from renovated wastewater and desalted 500 parts per million estuary water. Now, in this region of relatively plentiful surface water, neither groundwater nor desalted ocean water was selected as sources by the model. Now, it's better cost data become available, the model can be rerun to see how these changes affect the least cost solution. So looking into my crystal ball, I foresee that there will have to be institutional arrangements built around river basin commissions, which in turn may very well have to operate within regional resources or utility districts. The regional resource districts will be responsible for the conservation and use of at least air, water, and land. Perhaps these will be backstopped at the federal level by a Department of the Environment and Natural Resources, a grown-up environmental protection agency. In the future, therefore, I foresee a national effort organized along urban and environmental lines, coordinated by regional resource districts, which furnish an overview and direction for air, water, solid waste handling and reuse, and whose water policies serve as guides for operating river systems on a complete river basin basis. Now, I see our rivers and lake systems managed as entities both from a quality as well as a quantity standpoint, the quantity standpoint being the older traditional viewpoint. In some places, we may look upon the election, for example, of these resources commissions with interest equal to that of our state elections of today. And indeed, it should be noted that the states of Maryland and Pennsylvania are seriously considering and implementing regional water and waste management authorities at the present time. From a technical standpoint, water, sewage, solid waste, and power are completely interrelated and economically complementary. In fact, all of the pieces of the problem of urban utilities must be looked at as a system. You're dealing with very complex problems, very complex decision-making processes. In NASA, you're dealing with a very simple problem, a very simple decision-making process, all pyramided up to the head of NASA. You use a lot of complex technology to solve that. We can use a lot of simple technology to solve our problems.
Alan, you've spoken of water treatment technology, existing technology, which makes possible systems in which water is actually fully recycled. What's the cost of this treatment, say, in comparison to the two-stage wastewater treatment, which is good practice today?
The cost of treating water in a fairly large and efficient, what we call primary-secondary plant, which is a conventional treatment, would cost around 12 cents a thousand gallons. I recognize that we use maybe 80 gallons a day, and in some regions up to 150 gallons a day. This is literally nothing on your household bill in comparison to buying cigarettes or going to the movies or even telephone bills. 12 cents a thousand gallons. We would have to double that to 24 cents a thousand gallons to provide this extra treatment step, to provide virtually drinking water quality.
Doubling the modest cost of our water seems a reasonable cost for providing a virtually inexhaustible supply and also keeping our lakes and rivers clean. Are we willing to pay for it? And will the industrial polluters be forced to do their share? To continue, please stop your cassette player, turn the cassette over, and restart the machine.